Our reading this morning is from the Gospel of Mark. In chapter 12, we read verses 13 to 17. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay or shouldn't we?" But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. "Why are you trying to trap me?" he asked. "Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." They brought the coin, and he asked them, "Whose portrait is this, and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." And they were amazed at him. Lord, may we be amazed too.
My mother asked me last December what I wanted for Christmas, and I said, $12 cash, please. And that would be so that I could go to Hanover, to the Dutch store, and buy myself some smoked eel. It's $11.99, so $12, well, is sufficient. Cash is one of the best gifts, isn't it? It's the best. You can do what you like with it. But it does have one particular problem. And that problem children discover when they, for the very first time, having received cash as a gift, go and try and spend it at the store. So imagine the poor 5-year-old boy. He's got $30 from his grandparents. And he goes to the store and he sees an item, $27.99. And in his little mind, okay, 27, I don't know always about the 99, but yeah, it's less than 30. I can get this. So he gets the toy off the shelf, and he's even thinking to himself, 27, it's less than 30. I'll even have a little bit left over to get some Reese's Pieces. And he gets up to the cashier, and all of a sudden, that $27.99 has morphed into $31.64. And his dream of getting a few Reese's Pieces is gone. And he just cannot comprehend when the lady says, "Oh, I'm sorry, you don't have enough money. You need another $1.64. As parents, you've all probably been there. And you've probably tried to explain to your perplexed 5-year-old that's on the verge of tears that taxes are compulsory payments by individuals and corporations to the government which are levied to finance government services, redistribute income, and influence behavior of consumers and investors. Poor kids. I'm not going to go into the frustrations that we as adults have about taxes. Let's put that aside. But let us instead acknowledge that the Jewish leaders, as they send the Pharisees and as they send the Herodians to try to entrap Jesus, they were geniuses in selecting the area of taxation for their question. Brilliant area, brilliant question. Mark chapter 12, verse 14b. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them? Should we not? Now, to truly realize how cunning and how dangerous this question is. We need to look at the historical context, and we also need to look at the political mindset of the Jews. Now on the screen, you see a map of ancient Palestine. It's divided up according to the governing boundaries of that day in which Jesus lived. Now up in the far right-hand corner, there's an orangey-yellow area. That's the area of Iturea. It was governed by a partial Jew named Herod Philip. And then you have these two grayish areas in the center, Perea and Galilee. Those two areas were governed by another partial Jew named Herod Antipas. We encountered him earlier in our study of the Gospel of Mark, Mark chapter 6. Herod Antipas is the one who killed John the Baptist, or had John the Baptist murdered, his head cut off. That's the area Jesus grew up in. Jesus grew up in Galilee. He was under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. And then you have this turquoise, this kind of greenish-bluish area of Judea and Samaria. Now, this is the part we're interested in. It was ruled after Herod the Great died in 4 BC. From 4 BC to 6 AD, it was ruled by Herod Archelaus. He was a terrible ruler, incompetent, brutal, so much so the Romans didn't even like him. So in 6 AD, the Romans exiled Herod Archelaus and his wife to Gaul, which is modern-day France. And in his place, in Samaria and Judea, they joined it together, the Romans joined it together to become a Roman province, the province of Judea. And when Romans made an area of land their province, or a province, they ruled it directly. So before, with the Herods, the Herods would rule, and then they would be subservient to the Romans. But now, there's no Jew or partial Jew ruling Judea. The Romans set up a direct Roman governor, or a procurator, the one that we all know as Pontius Pilate, and that would be the one at the time of Mark 12. And they set up this Roman governor, and as part of his duties, he would collect taxes from the people living in the province. And they would collect them directly. So the money and the taxes would go directly into Roman coffers or Roman chests, into the Roman treasury. And they would, in a sense, be taking money out of the area through these taxes. Now, in 6 AD, when this switch was made to Judea and Samaria being a Roman province that was directly ruled, there was a man named Judas, a Galilean Jew from the region of Galilee. Jesus himself would have been an early teenager at this time. And this man, Judas, along with a Pharisee named Sadduc, did not believe that the Jews should pay taxes to the Romans. They thought it was morally wrong. This is the land God gave us. We're God's people, not the Romans' people. We cannot pay taxes to them. So Judas, in 6 AD, started a revolt, an armed rebellion against the Romans over taxes. Now, the Romans did what they did very well in those days. They crushed the revolt. Now, understanding that little bit of history, here we are about 25, 26, 27 years later, you can now see the danger of this question. If Jesus says, no, do not pay taxes to the Romans, it's not lawful, then the Pharisees and the Herodians are going to make a short trip over to the governor, the Roman governor's residence, to Pontius Pilate, and they're going to say, sir, history is repeating itself. Do you remember how 25 years ago there was a radical Galilean named Judas who came to Judea and started a revolt over taxes? Well, now we got another radical Galilean. His name's Jesus, and he's got a tremendous following. He's here now, and he's stirring up people to revolt and not pay taxes. That answer, if Jesus says yes, or Jesus says no, do not pay taxes, that may gain a lot of favor with the people, but it's going to cause Rome to see him as a traitor, and they're going to arrest him and execute him. And of course, that's what the chief priests, the scribes, the elders want. They want Jesus to say, no, don't pay your taxes, so that the Romans will arrest him and kill him. Dangerous question. Now, the political mindset, they had a lot of taxes to pay. But the tax in question here is a poll tax or a head tax. And actually, it's not a large amount. And it was paid directly to the Romans. It was one denarius, which elsewhere in the scripture it says it's about a day's wage. So one day out of all your working days, that's the amount of this tax. So it's not tremendously large. But what irritated the Judean Jews is that it was not paid to, it was paid to Rome directly, paid to foreigners. It was not paid to the Jews. I didn't think you wanted to hear that. And as they paid that tax, they were reminded that they were not governing themselves. They were reminded that they had to submit to a foreign government that neither recognized their God nor abided by the laws of their God. And beyond this desire to be self-governing, there was the moral debate about the rightness or wrongfulness of paying the tax. Because politically and historically, the Jews were the people of God. God had selected them, brought them out of Israel. He brought them into this land. He gave them the land. So what right does the Romans have to be masters of this land? What right do the Romans have to rule us? Our master is God, not the Romans. So there was this moral, spiritual dilemma or question that was raised among them. Is it lawful? That is, according to God's will, should we or should we not pay taxes? God's original design is God is our ruler. We submit to God, not to Rome. We're not Rome's servant. We're not Caesar's servant. We're God's servant. So if we pay this tax, that's a submitting to Caesar and admitting we're his servant. Is there not something wrong with this picture? This is what is going through their mind. Is it immoral to pay this tax because then we're submitting to Rome? Are we being disloyal to God? Are we an unfaithful servant to God? Some people, like Judas the Galilean, like some of the Pharisees and definitely the Zealots, thought so. This is morally wrong. That's why they started the rebellion. So now, understanding the political mindset of the Jews, we can understand that if Jesus says, yes, pay the tax, it saves him from being arrested and executed, but then many of the Jews are going to turn away from him. Many of the Jews are going to say, I'm not following this guy anymore. Because many of them have been hurt and abused by the Roman government. And not only that, they expected a Messiah that was going to get rid of the Romans. As I explained earlier, as we've gone through Mark, the general popular but slightly errant view of the Messiah among the Jewish population was the Messiah is going to come and kick out the Romans. So if Jesus says, no, pay your taxes to them and continue to submit, that doesn't connect or jive with what they're thinking in the popular thinking of the culture. So he's going to lose a lot of his audience. And that too is what the Pharisees and the Herodians, the chief priests, want. So either way Jesus answers, it's going to bring some type of harm. That's at least what they're hoping for. So, Jesus, as to answer this tricky, difficult, cunning, dangerous question, and to paraphrase the first part of his reply in verses 15 and 16, he says, "Show me the money." And they bring him a denarius. Now, the fact that they have to bring him a denarius, and as you see on the screen, that's an actual picture of the denarius that they would have used to pay this tax. The fact that they have to bring one to Jesus means he probably doesn't have one, which would reflect upon his dependence upon others. Remember, Jesus had an itinerant ministry. He went around. He depended upon the gifts of others and the charity of others. Jesus was not rich. He was poor. To ask him to show a denarius would be like us asking, remember, it's equal to a day's wage, so it's a large denomination. It'd be like us asking for the normal person on the street for a $100 bill. And he asked them, he says, whose image is on it? Whose inscription's on it? As you see, the head of Tiberius is on it. And on that side, when you translate it, it says, Tiberius Caesar, August son of the divine Augustus. And on the other side, as you see, there's a woman sitting on a throne. She has a spear and a palm leaf. And the inscription translated means high priest. Both of the inscriptions would have been blasphemous or offensive to the Jews, who were monotheistic. But the Pharisees answer, well, the image is Caesar's. It's Caesar's image. And then Jesus goes on to complete his answer. Verse 17, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God. So by having them identify that the image on the coin is Caesar's, Jesus establishes, well, the coin is Caesar's. And the fact that you guys have it mean you're using Caesar's services. You're using his roads. You're using his money and financial system. So Caesar has already given to you. He's already provided things for you. So render or give back what is due to Caesar. He's provided the roads. He's kept the peace. He's done these things. So pay your tax. Give him back what you owe him for these services. So Jesus escapes the charge of treason. But he also says, give to God what is God's. He distinguishes Caesar from God. He draws a line between the two and separates them, where the coin does not, but he does. Jesus takes an extra step. And he actually does not agree with the inscription that the Caesars are divine. Give to Caesars what is Caesar's, give to God's what is God's. And that will sit well with the people. Now we hear this, and we think, that is clever. That is just brilliant. What an answer. But his reply is far more than just solving a difficult puzzle. His reply is more than a clever escape. When we stop and think about the actual political beliefs and the religious thinking of that time, Jesus is deeply challenging the political and religious thinking of his time, and he is laying down a foundation for a proper relationship between people and government, which will be enlarged or taught upon more elsewhere in the scriptures. But let us just stay sticking with this passage. Here are two key affirmations that Jesus makes regarding politics and religion. First of all, he legitimizes or he authorizes human government as lawful and proper. In other words, human government, humans governing humans, is right, morally right, good, God-ordained. Anarchy. The absence of government, the state of lawlessness where everyone does what is right in their own eyes, is not a legitimate option for humans. That's not a legitimate way to live. That is ruled out. Anarchy is ruled out because God, Jesus, has legitimatized human government as right and proper. By saying that even the Jews of his day had to pay taxes to the Romans, Jesus was recognizing human government as legitimate, even in the form of one you may not like. Because the Jews didn't like the Roman government, and they considered them pagan. But Jesus says, pay your taxes to them. He authorized, he validated the Roman government. And this is something because in just a couple days of this question, Jesus is going to be standing before the Roman governor. He's going to be standing before Pontius Pilate with the Jewish leaders there calling for his death, for his execution. And Jesus will submit to the authority of the Roman government. But he also reveals in a conversation with Pilate that that authority that Pilate has been given to him from God. You could take a look at it at John 19, chapter 19, verses 10 and 11. It says, "So Pilate said to him, 'Will you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?' Jesus answered him, 'You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above.'" So Jesus is saying, you wouldn't have any authority if it hadn't been given to you from God. So he recognizes the Roman government. He recognizes the governor's authority to make a decision about whether he lives or dies. So what does this affirmation that God has ordained or set up or brings about and sets up governments, and that it is right and good that we be governed by humans, what does that mean practically? Well, first of all, it means we need to integrate or bring together in our thinking both God and government. Lest you do not misunderstand, I do not mean that we are to join secular government and the church together as one governing body. That's not what I mean when I say we need to bring together our thinking of God and politics. No, I'm not saying we bring together the church and the secular government and make an institution out of it. That has been done numerous times in the past to great and disastrous consequences. That's not the way to go, and that's not what I'm saying. What I mean when I say we need to bring together in our thinking both God and government is that as a disciple of Jesus, or as disciples of Jesus, we need to search the scriptures and develop the words of God, develop the theology, a biblical understanding of human government as God has decreed it and set it up, and what his purposes he has given to government and why he has given them authority. And then how do we relate to that government? And how do we serve in the government as God has decreed? See, if you're like me, more often than not, when it comes to politics and governments and elections and passing laws, we separate God and politics in our thinking. And we don't usually let the two cross unless, of course, maybe the government is passing a law that's dealing with a moral issue like euthanasia or same-sex marriage. Then we bring the two together in our thinking. But when I go to vote or when we look at different political parties and look at their different theories and their financial platforms and economic platforms and their labor platforms and all this type of stuff, you know, do we really bring God into the thinking to evaluate and discern the political ideology? If we do not, if it's true that we keep God and politics separate in our mind, then whatever we are thinking about politics is just merely our own political ideals rather than God's truth. And that's not good. That's not healthy. Because it is God who ordains governments. It's God who sets up and takes down governments. He says that, I believe, in the scriptures. And he set their purposes for the government. So we must not allow political ideology or personal desires to shape and form our political views and engagement, but instead we must allow the Word of God and His will for government to shape our political ideology, our political involvement, our political service, etc. So that's what I mean by bringing the two together, because if God is the one setting up the government, God is saying it's morally right to have more government, then we need to bring what God has said and taught about government into our thinking about government. And then the second practical thing that comes from Jesus or God legitimatizing and authorizing human government as lawful and proper is that if we break the laws of our government, we're sinning against God. Often we think sin is just some of the moral issues, you know, some of the things about sex or drunkenness or lying and cheating or murder. But if we don't obey our government laws, that is just as morally wrong and just as equally sin as is to have an abortion or to murder someone or to rob someone or to commit fraud, whatever. Not obeying our government laws is also sin. The example and the question in Mark 12 relates to payment of taxes. Is it lawful, they ask? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? What that means is it morally right? Is it a good, righteous thing to do to pay taxes, or is it a sinful thing to pay taxes to Rome? That's the question. Jesus says, yes, it's right. It is morally right to pay your taxes. Therefore, not to pay your taxes is immoral. It is sinful. Because Jesus says, give to Caesar, give to the CRA what is due them. Taxation, though we might not like this, taxation, in principle, is affirmed by Jesus as a legitimate exercise of power and revenue by the government. It's clearly stated as much later, as much in Romans 13, 6 to 7. Paul the Apostle says same thing. Second key affirmation that we learn from this text is that while it is necessary and lawful for God's people to honor human government, there are some things that belong to God alone. So this comes to that distinction where Jesus says, you give to Caesar's what is Caesar's and you give to God's what is God's. Now we take this for granted today because we grow up in a secular society. The official cultural, spiritual philosophy of our country is secularism. So none of our prime ministers are going around like Caesar did saying, you know, I'm God. They're not that silly. Though they may act like gods, but they aren't claiming to be gods. So we kind of take this for granted. We don't see our leaders as divine and high priests. So when Jesus says, you know, render, give back to God what is God's, he's putting limits on the authority of the state. We kind of understand that as Christians or as disciples of Jesus Christ. We know that the government cannot play or be God. They cannot declare themselves to be God, and they cannot demand our worship, they can't demand the ultimate allegiance of citizens. However, Rome, Caesar would do exactly that within just a few centuries, couple decades or less of the death of Christ. They would be demanding all their citizens to burn incense to Caesar as a god. They would send out the civil servants to every village, and in the village they would set up a spot, a little altar, And then they would call the roll call of the village, of all who were registered in the village. Come over here on this altar, bring a little bit of incense, burn it, and say, Caesar is Lord, Caesar is God. And they did that through the whole Roman Empire. And the disciples of Jesus, based on what Jesus has said in this text, are going to have to say no. We cannot burn incense on this altar. We cannot say Caesar is Lord or Caesar is God. We'll have to be like Daniel, the ancient prophet, who refused to pray to the Persian king Darius when they passed the law. For the next X number of days, you can only pray to King Darius. They will have to do the very same thing. They will have to say no. So whenever heads of state declare themselves to be God, whenever they declare themselves to be divine and demand worship, God approves of his people to revolt. He approves of us in our civil disobedience to say, no, Caesar, whoever the governor or the ruler is, no, we cannot obey you on this. We refuse. Because worship belongs to God alone. You have overstepped your boundaries. So we are free before God and commanded by God to say no, to revolt against this law. I remember in the 1990s when I was in my first church in Unionville, in Markham, I received a letter from the mayor of Toronto. And it had this phrase, Your Worship, the Mayor of Toronto, Barbara Hall. And ironically, at that time, I was doing a sermon series on worship. Well, needless to say, that little phrase pushed my button. And I wrote her a letter. I said, listen, I can call you your honor, your most deserved, respectful, whatever, mayor. But I said, we cannot use the term worship. That term signifies ultimate allegiance and honor given to God. And you're not God. You have overstepped your bounds putting this phrase on your letter. You must change it. But not only does God alone reserve worship for himself, but he reserves for himself our full obedience, complete obedience to his revealed will. So when a government or a ruler goes beyond merely passing laws that allow others to disobey God, for example, we have really no abortion law in Canada. People are free to have abortions. The government allows it. It's not right. It's wrong. It's immoral. But if the government went beyond that and said, okay, we require all women to have an abortion, like they did in China, under the one policy, child policy, if you have a second kid, you are required by law to abort it, then we would have to dissent. We would have to say no, because they are then compelling us to disobey God by that law or whatever law it is. Then we must disobey. Again, within a few months of this very conversation in Mark chapter 12, the disciples of Christ, the apostles, would have to revolt. They would have to dissent against their very own Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin, for overstepping their bounds, demanding them not to do something that Christ had commanded them to do. You'll find it in Acts chapter 4 and chapter 5. The Sanhedrin had told the apostles, do not teach in the name of Jesus. Well, they just kept doing it anyway. So they called them in, and this is how it goes, Acts chapter 5, verse 27 to 29. And when they had brought them, they set before them the council, and the high priest questioned them, saying, we strictly charged you not to teach in this name. Yet here you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching, and you intended to bring this man's blood upon us. But Peter and the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than men. And you search the scriptures, you will find other situations where God's people were commanded, demanded by various governments to do things that were wrong. The midwives were told by Pharaoh to kill the babies. They did not. Others were told to kill the prophets. They did not. They hid them. They protected them. Others were told to worship idols, pray to certain gods. They did not. So whenever the will of a human government of any kind, whatever form of human government it may be a religious form of human government, it may be a parental form of human government, it may be an educational form of government, you know, the principal or the educational council or whatever, or district school board. It may be a military form of human government. It may be a tribal form. It may be the civic government. Whatever form it is, whenever they demand us to do that which contradicts the clear will of God, or they set themselves up as God and demand ultimate loyalty, then we must dissent. Because they have overstepped their God-ordained bounds and mandate that God has given them. And they are claiming for themselves things that only are to be given to God. We must then join, like the apostles, like the others in the scriptures, and we must say we must obey God rather than you, and even as necessary, suffer dreadful consequences for it. Some of them said that we will not burn incense to Caesar, and they were executed. Or they were thrown out of the trade guild, the trade union, and no one would hire them. And so they were thrust into poverty. Why must we do this? Because, as Jesus says, there are some things that are only given to God, and Jesus will shortly say in Mark chapter 12, we're going to come to it in a couple weeks, verses 29 to 30, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength." This type of loyalty and this kind of devotion belongs only to God, not to the government. And when they ask for that, they have overstepped their bounds. Render to Caesar what is Caesar's. Pay your taxes. Obey the laws. But there are some things that are God's alone. I ask for the team to come forward.